What is happening, you guys? Welcome back to Let's Go Win podcast, where we're here to help you be happy, healthy, wealthy, and get better every single day. We're going to be talking to a guy that has been around the world. He's worked at a pretty amazing company, still does. He's done some cool stuff, and I think you guys are going to ton on his leadership, talking about some work-life balance. We're going to cover some cool stuff today. Dave McCoury serves as the Chief Commercial Officer at HP, overseeing global sales, go-to-market strategies, revenue generation, and margin management. With extensive leadership experience in the IT industry, he joined HP in 2017 and has excelled in various roles, including General Manager of Personal Systems category. Dave is known for his customer-centric and data-driven approach, leveraging his international background, having lived and worked in six countries. He champions HP's values and serves as an executive sponsor for the HP Disabilities Impact Network, showcasing his commitment to purpose-driven leadership. Love that. Dave, how you doing, brother?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on. It's nice to hear my bio. Thank you.
Well, you nailed it, man. I have a lot of questions just on the bio, but I want to go to the Disabilities Impact Network because you don't hear that often, right? You hear accolades and you hear some cool stuff that people have done, but I think this is really a cool thing because it talks about the purpose-driven leadership, and that's a huge thing that we talk about on this show. What is the HP Disabilities Impact Network? What is that, brother?
A lot of companies call it an ERG, an employee resource group, so we just have a different nomenclature for it, but it's a group of people in each country, and we have them all around the world, who have a passion for and a commitment to advancing those with disabilities in our company and in our communities. And so it runs the gamut from how we engage into the community, those affected groups, to how we make sure that our offices and our work practices are inclusive and welcoming to people, whether that disability is a physical disability, all the way through to neuro and other diverse people. So it's something that I have been involved with for a few years in the company, and it for me was born when my second daughter was born, because I have three children and one of them has a developmental disability, and so it's been a part of my life for quite a while, and she is an inspiration, and so getting involved with this was an easy choice.
I love that. It sounds like your background, being that you've six different countries that you've worked in, I don't even know if that counts all the places you've lived, but really being open to other people's perspectives and ideas, and the fact that culturally it is so different in different areas. It sounds like that's something that is really important to you. Tell me about this whole living all over the place, man. Where'd that come from?
Well, I mean, it's six places. A few of them I've done more than once. So Australia twice, Singapore twice, Norway twice, and then France, Denmark, and the US. It came about because I was keen to move internationally with work when I was in my early 20s, and I was working at the time for Dell, and I got the chance with them, and I got going and started up to Singapore and just kept going. Now, I mentioned to you just as we were beginning that I have a Norwegian wife, and so one of us was going to be living away from home no matter where we were, and that made it both attractive to and easy to keep moving, and I've been fortunate to have opportunities with different companies in different places that have always taken us somewhere. The point you make about culture and difference and perspective is really important to me. I come from Australia. Australia is a very large country, far from a lot of places. And many Australians travel, but many don't. And we're here in the US, and many Americans travel within the US, and many don't travel outside the US. And what I have discovered from traveling and living in different places is that I think everybody should have to be a foreigner for a while. Everybody should have to be a visitor in someone else's country for a while, because the perspective, the humility you get from not understanding the language, from being the person that others have to adapt to rather than always being the one that you're the local and others are kind of having to adapt around, it gives you a lot. It has given me a lot. And so I have gotten a great benefit from these travels and from living in these places, meeting these people, but also realize that the more of us around the planet that can do that, the better a world we will be in, because the humility and the acceptance and the perspective that we would all gain would be material.
Yeah, you've said that word a couple times, and it's something that I've talked about on the show previously, but I don't think we can talk about it enough. That word humility, especially when it comes to leadership, when people ask me often, what's the most important thing a leader has as an attribute? Often it is that word. It is truly being humble, truly serving. And you've said that word two or three times already. How has that shown up in your career, Dave? Why is humility so important in leadership? How have you found that in a practical sense in the business world that it's clearly served you well? You've held some pretty amazing positions at some pretty awesome companies, but yet you still are such a humble, kind man. And again, I haven't known you long, but that's certainly the persona that you come across with. You know, how's that served you in your career?
I feel that everyone who knows me would call me humble and kind. So I'll go for humble, kind, I'm working on. How's it served me? I think it's led me to be curious more. And I have to keep reminding myself as I go through my career and as we all build expertise or perspective or experience to remain curious, because I meet new people every day that know things that I am in awe of. And so that constant exposure to brilliance, and brilliance can be the person you meet in the supermarket who has a perspective on, you know, the world that you don't have, all the way through to a person you meet through work. But I am inspired by the people around me, and I am therefore humbled a little every time I deal with people who are amazing at their thing, whatever their thing is. And like I said, it doesn't have to be work, but there's also something cultural about it. Australians tend to be, and I would say I am, pretty relaxed about, you know, who they're meeting. If they're meeting, you know, the janitor or the member of the royal family, they're going to treat them the same, probably refer to them in the same way, and certainly expect the same basic methods of engaging. So I guess there's a little bit that I was, you know, I grew up around, and a lot that has come through living and working in different places around the world.
Yeah, that perspective piece and truly having obviously a curious mindset. I call it a growth mindset, that you clearly don't believe that you've arrived, that there's more to learn, and that's evident as you continue. Holding some of these leadership roles, Dave, I'm really curious, when you think of some of the great leaders that you've been around, whether it's at HP or you mentioned Dell, you've seen different cultures and you've seen different leadership. I'm sure vast leaders, some good, some bad, or at least that's been my experience. In your experience, when you think of amazing leadership, do you have certain attributes that come to mind that you're like, man, this is 100% where we got to start? This is permission to play, and this is how you really accelerate to succeed and truly to be a successful leader, whether it's a large company like HP or your own small, solopreneur.
Yeah. There are a few. The first, we talked about humility, is important to me. I think you can't take yourself seriously. Everybody I know, me, my boss, my peers, every leader I've ever met, is where they are through a combination of factors, not solely in their own control. And so the idea that you are humble about and don't take too seriously yourself and your accomplishments is really important to me in a leader. The second is lateral thinking. I have always admired, and some of the best leaders I've worked with have demonstrated lateral thinking. It's something that some people are born with, indeed, but it's also very easy to practice and get better at through practice. And so it's not something that I feel is out of the grasp of many. I just see people who practice it as really strong leaders and really inspiring leaders. And then the last would be that they are focused almost always on the advancement of the team or the business versus their own ambition. And it's a difficult one, because I have no problem with ambition. I'm personally ambitious, but the method by which you should advance is because you allowed, helped, encouraged others to advance, and the team or the company you led to advance. And as a result, you should move with it, rather than, you know, the goal is that you move upward and everybody else is just around you to support that. So people who are I guess servant leadership would be the reference that, you know, our industries use. That'd be the third one that I look for and have always seen very positively in leaders.
I want to dive into lateral thinking because it's probably the first time I've heard that. I love it. I think I understand what you're saying, but I'm like, you know what? Maybe I don't. Maybe Dave is talking about something that he's going to open my mind to something that I've never thought of because I haven't worked at a global company like HP. What, when you say lateral thinking, can you give me an example of exactly what that looks like and how people can get better at doing it? If it's clearly it's important enough that you brought it up, I want to know that I'm doing it, man.
So I'll start with a book recommendation. I do a lot of this. I recommend books. I see some behind you, so I'll give you another one. It's called, perhaps predictably, Lateral Thinking by a gentleman named Edward de Bono, who was a well-thought-of speaker in the 80s, 90s. He wrote that book. I encourage everybody to read it. It's written a little bit like it's for school teachers, but it has lots of practical examples of both what lateral thinking is and how to practice it. At its most simple, it just means coming at the problem from outside or from this side. And too often people think in a linear fashion. I think based on what they're being told. They think based on the current constraints or the current reality. And lateral thinkers ask different questions. They ask questions that would challenge the status quo or challenge. I hear occasionally people refer to it as going back to first principles. It's another method of applying a different way of problem solving than just dealing with what you see. But for me, lateral thinking is best demonstrated by people who pause before addressing the problem to ensure that they're not leaping into it in a frontal or a linear fashion and ask questions around it as a way of attempting to solve the issue.
I imagine that's pretty important with a company like HP. You know, we talked about you living in different countries around the world, and yet our world has shrunk in terms of you and I are coming in. I'm in Florida. I'm guessing you're in the Bay Area, but heck, all I know, you could be somewhere around the world. And that's the beauty of the technology. And really, HP is helping bring our world to a closer place. We're more connected, yet we're global. I'm guessing lateral thinking, in order to achieve the things, whether it be an Elon Musk with Tesla or, you know, Apple or HP, I mean, that's just a huge part of what these companies, these founders have come up with is like, that's crazy. At some point, somebody says something and they're like, no, dude, that's literally insane. Yet they're the ones really changing the landscape of the world, our economy. Is that a big prerequisite to working at a company like HP?
I mean, it's not a prerequisite because unfortunately, I don't think everybody yet practices it. And so if it were, we'd have to go through the ranks and find who was doing it to the extent we want. I think of it slightly differently, and that is it's something I encourage and ask of everybody I work with that they keep working on it. You mentioned a couple of, you know, impressive leaders there. Let's pick on Elon Musk. The notion that an electric car could also be fast and cool was for me an example of a lateral thought. Until that moment, electric cars had been by their nature uninspiring, at least visually and performance-wise, because their stated purpose was electrical efficiency or battery-driven automotive. And he and others decided that that constraint was not a valid one. And so they went and built, you know, some capabilities into a car that others hadn't thought about. So I think it's a great example of lateral thinking. And yes, at our company and any company, it differentiates both the people and if there are enough people practicing it, then the company. One example that we have here recently is we acquired Poly, the large AV company, a couple of years ago. And this meeting we're having, which is remote, it has been forever true that when you walk into a meeting room, the tech in that meeting room is not aware of who you are. It's not easy to connect. Just before you and I got on, we were going through making sure that all of our tech worked well. And we just all accept that. And we at HP, we don't think you should accept that. So we have a vision for the fact that when you walk into a room, the room figures out that that's you. If you're carrying your PC or you're carrying a device that allows you to connect, an HP device, it'll automatically join the meeting. It'll turn microphones and cameras on. It'll turn speakers off. It'll put acoustic fences around the speakers so that noise behind them doesn't get picked up. It'll use AI to pick up who's speaking in the room from the camera on the wall. This is a vision for this sort of work we're doing, hybrid work, that nobody else has thought through or has articulated, and you know, we're building and pursuing. So it's something that is important to us because it allows us to reimagine the way people work, and the way people work is changing pretty dramatically over the last few years.
Yeah, clearly that's happened. The pandemic shifted everything for, you know, good or bad. It shifted the way we work today. And it is interesting how this has almost become normal, you know, doing these type of meetings. It wasn't long ago that this was a major step. I'm curious from your vantage point, when we're doing so much of this remote work, there's some challenges when it comes to leadership, because when we had that in-office culture, you really could, HR hopefully isn't listening, you know, put your arm around them and really say, hey, I see you. Some of that's gone away to where, yes, I can say it, but it may not be the same. How are you addressing the fact that it's incredible? You can work from home and do so many efficient, things without having to have this huge overhead. Yet there's some challenges. What are you seeing in this work environment, Dave? And I know it's been a couple of years now, so we should be used to it. But I'm seeing some companies really struggle culturally because they've lost that touch. What are you seeing?
I think more companies are struggling than not. I don't know many companies who figured this out. And figured this out, I don't mean made a mandate, right? Nobody comes back to work. Everybody comes back to work. These are mandates. That doesn't mean figured it out. That just means taking a position and hoping that position is going to work out. So far, with a few exceptions, obviously, if you work physically in a hospital or you're a police officer, you go to work. And that has been true through the pandemic, and it will remain true for the future. For the rest of knowledge workers, where to work and how to work and whether it's in an office, most companies are still figuring out. The thing that's interesting about why we are where we are, and then we'll get to what we ought to do about it, but why we are where we are is, to your point, leaders through the last decades, maybe hundreds of years, have had precisely what you described. They have had proximity. It has been a standard operating model of how we work. We work with each other. We're physically there. We can spot micro movements that somebody does that tells us whether or not they're engaging. We can see, as you said, respectfully touch the workers that we and the colleagues that we have. And most leaders have not adapted to the change. At HP, we ran a large survey recently that said, that discovered that the majority of employees feel that their leaders have not changed their style to acknowledge this different method of working. And so for all of us as leaders, that's the challenge. It's not so much what's the right answer, because for every company, and even within companies, every team, the answer could be different. For our engineers, being in the office to collaborate or stand around a circuit board or a whiteboard to design something, this is important. For a person who's doing analysis on a spreadsheet, they can work at home on that work. So we aren't going to have one answer as a company. But as a leader, as a group of leaders, acknowledging that people feel more remote, they feel less seen, they don't have those moments in between, you know, the water cooler moments or the corridor conversation, and adapting how we engage, this is our responsibility. And so far, as a collective, we are not rising to the challenge.
Yeah, and to support that, it wasn't long ago Gallup did a poll, and they're showing 71% of human beings currently in the workforce are currently disengaged. 71. So 10 people walking down the hall, only three of them are jazzed to be there. That's crazy. But the number one reason they found is exactly what you said. I call it EPR, encourage, praise, and recognize. They don't feel seen. How do we fix this? How do we course correct, brother? Because I hate the fact that 70% of people are like, I really don't want to be here right now. Yeah. We spend 30% of our lives going to work. Shouldn't we be happy doing it?
Yes, let's start there. Yes, we ought to be happy doing it. It's a big change. And it's everything from, you know, the mundane, like how you allocate your time, right? So what you used to get almost by default, just as a consequence of being there, you've now got a schedule, whether that's time with people or connecting to those people or And this sounded crazy during the pandemic, but we did it like virtual happy hours and virtual coffees where people would come together in a way they used to because they couldn't do it in person, to try and recapture that part of the job and of the work that was so important. But the discipline around acknowledging first that it has changed and applying time specifically to recapturing or to recreating that which is missing. Most of us don't do it. We're too busy, or we just assume that it will take care of itself. And so for me, being deliberate about it is the first step. The second is there's a lot of content out there on how to handle this different world that we're in. And so whether it's conversations like this and how we frame and how we allocate the time we're going to spend to when you should come into the office and I should come into the office if we have that opportunity so we can be there together, to how do we ensure that we're giving space for what would normally happen in a one-on-one or in a in-person conversation, which is harder here, some of those tactics and practices. There's a lot of content out there, and I think leaders should, on this subject and many others, be constantly reading and constantly learning so that that which is known, we can know. Because, you know, there is nothing new under the sun, as the expression goes. And I feel like leaders who read and who are, back to where we started, humble about the fact that they can continue to learn, are going to be best placed. When you couple that hunger to learn with some discipline and some practices that we talked about, I think people will improve. It's not going to be a silver bullet, but it's going to be improved versus where we are today.
Yeah, I love how you made it. And I mean that as a compliment. Look, recognize the fact that it's different. Continue to educate yourself on this subject, whether it be leadership. And really, you're talking about being human. Reach out to this person and say, hey, I see you. I'm not physically with you, and I recognize that. I want to throw something else out there. You put up the number earlier, and this is actually one of the topics. You guys did a work-life balance, it looks like a survey, and 83% of workers will take a pay cut if it means a better work-life balance. Now, it's fascinating. This is so interesting to me because I say work-life balance, and I'll have people go, bullshit, it doesn't exist. Okay, that's a stance. And perhaps, again, now we can go country by country, and I'm really curious to hear this. You know, the way we work in the U.S. is far different than how, let's say, it is in Spain. We have a far different conception of what work should be. And I think a large part, because we're talking about, we're both in the States, maybe we have lost this work-life balance. Like, we don't get it, and yet so many other countries have figured this piece out. What did the data tell you, Dave? What's happening there? Because I'm not kidding. I'll say work-life balance, and often people will say, that doesn't exist. You're full of it.
So first, what did the data tell us? The creep of work into the home, because when the pandemic started, we were working from home, has persisted. So even though we can come back to work, many of the practices that used to be acceptable during the pandemic have persisted. I'll give you a simple example in our day. Here in the US on the West Coast, because if you have a global role, you end up doing calls early in the day, very early to catch Asia, and then through the course of the morning with Europe, and then again in the evening to catch Asia again, and then through the course of the day in the US, of course, you're talking to people. But because people commuted to offices, we used to have a relatively small amount of very early calls on our team, on our people's calendars. When the pandemic hit, there was no commute, and so the calls could start early, and they did. And as we've all come back, they remain. And so now a lot of people who used to get on the phone or in meetings at 7:30, 8, 8:30 are now doing so at 6, 6:37 because of a practice we started but haven't stopped. And there are dozens of examples like that, whether it's how our calendars have changed, it's the amount of time in between, it's the assumption that because you don't have to physically move from one place to another, that meetings can happen more often. It's the problem that you just described, which is we're not seeing as much of each other. So we're trying to increase the one-on-one and the time in between. These all have led to this feeling you describe of people saying there's no such thing as work-life balance. my view on how to deal with that, and at least the way that I deal with that, is if you're a knowledge worker, if your output is what you're paid for, then you should focus on that. Rather than allocating time and worry to, am I showing the company that I'm available? Am I answering that email the instant that I get it, which means I've always got to be on, which means I don't have work-life balance. Focus on the things you deliver. If what you're delivering is meaningful, then when you put your phone down or your PC down and you move away from work to life, if that's how you think of it, so with confidence, don't regret that you're not working. I find a lot of people will constantly be picking up their phone and they'll see an email from their boss, or they'll worry that there's an email that they haven't answered. That'll be playing in the back of their mind. And I think there is this, again, to come back to it, this discipline we need. It says, when I'm not working, I'm not working. And I need to be okay with that, because when I'm working, I'm giving everything I got, and the company's getting from me what it needs and for what I owe it. And I worry that people feel they're not able to break away or step away. And it has been both my view and my practice and my counsel to people in our company that when you're working, that's terrific. But when you're not, you need to lean into not working, because the worst thing you can do is not be working for us, but not be doing the thing that you purport to be doing, whether it's spending time with your family or spending time on your own. And so I think there's a level of admitting that when you're not working, you need to be fully committed to that thing, so that when you are working, you can be fully committed there, and that it's okay to have both of those two things make up different parts of your life.
Yeah, that's certainly something I early in my career, I was so guilty of. At home with the kids, doing emails, 50% of me is maybe there. Physically, I'm there, but I'm not really engaged. But yet that's spilling over into my own work life, because I'm doing the same thing. I'm worrying about the fact that I'm not spending enough time with my family. So setting those boundaries, like, I think is where you're getting to, Dave. It's like, look, have the discipline. I love that, because discipline equals freedom. I think as a leader, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when you look at people that really do exceptional work for you, they have that ability to do the deep work when they're there fully engaged, and then yet they're off playing. Often you see the highest performers, they are so good about shutting down and just doing whatever thing they're doing in that moment. Is that been the case for you? Because we don't say it often enough as leaders. We probably don't talk about this often enough. But I'm curious, in your case, if that's when you see your highest level of performers, do they have that discipline?
Do. And the thing that, so yes is the answer. The thing that is terrible about our, you know, this dynamic is, too many people in the workforce feel that they might be judged poorly for not being fully focused on work at any moment that the work might need them. And as you and I just, as you just said, well, and I agree with, we regard more highly those who are able to give everything while they're with us and then give everything to whatever they're doing when they're not. And so the irony is, the person that worries that they're not giving enough is actually, because they're half-half, right? Because they're half in all these situations. There becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So my strong perspective is, if you can apply the discipline to be fully committed to do the work, if you are proud of the work you do, if you are making change and getting results in your job, and when you're not doing that, do whatever else it is that's important to you with the same vigor and discipline and attention, and then come back and do the work the next day or the next hour. It doesn't matter what the frequency is. It just matters that you're all in to whatever it is you're doing. So, yeah, I find that the most impressive leaders are the ones who are able to unapologetically focus on something else, and that when they're with us, they're uncompromising about their focus and their contribution at work.
Yeah, I love it. You know, Dave gave a great book recommendation earlier. I'll give one right now, and that's Drive by Daniel Pink. He talks about result-only work environment. It doesn't matter if you do 40 hours a week. That doesn't mean anything to me. 60 hours a week, that just means you're somewhat inefficient, probably. I care about the results. And I hope more of you can hear this. Spend time with your family. Be really engaged, and then be really engaged at work. You're going to lead such a happier life. Dave, you had brought up AI earlier, And I meant to ask you then, but I have to. This has clearly shaped our world quickly. It's continuing. I mean, you're in tech, so you know far more than I. What are you seeing? I guess it's a pretty open question, but what are you seeing, the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to AI, and how are you guys using it to your advantage? Because the genie's out of the bottle. The fear should go away. Like, look, you can't put it back in. This is our world. Are you seeing it being advantageous in your work, or is there some real stuff we should be scared of?
Any tool, any technology can be used for good or for evil, one might claim. Certainly some technologies are used in both directions. This one here, I think, has far more opportunity for good than for nefarious purposes. And we are focused on the good. The first thing I would say is AI as a technology has been around for decades. In fact, it was in the mid-50s, early 60s that it was first born. AI that we all use and experience today is pervasive in many products. It's pervasive in many software and apps and other services that we're all exposed to. Generative AI, the thing that has taken the world by storm in the last year or so, is transformative in its own or on its own. And I don't know whether it's a good analogy, but I consider it similar to the advent of electricity. It's that transformational, because we already use AI for many things. I talked about our cameras already have AI using them for face tracking so that they know which face in the room is doing the talking and they can focus in on that one. Our printers use AI in old or present in machine learning to use sensors to listen for the sound of a drum that might be about to fail so we can proactively replace it before the printer experiences a failure. This is AI and it's been used for years. Generative AI is going to transform once again the landscape. We have a number of products in the pipeline for that. The place that is going to be the most apparent to most people is the AI PC, which is something that we've announced in the last month, and we will continue to roll more products out. The reason this is going to be different is people today use AI from the cloud. So you go to, if you have ChatGPT, you ask a question, it goes up to the cloud, it grinds, it comes back, gives you an answer. And today, all generative AI is happening in the cloud. But the ability for you to do it locally, some of that work locally, doesn't exist today in any meaningful fashion. And we're bringing that to market this year. And that will mean three things to customers. It'll mean faster. It'll mean more secure because your data doesn't have to leave the device, which a lot of people do worry about in terms of their privacy. And it'll mean more cost effective, because as the cloud grows, you're going to expect cost to go up. So we think there's a big transformation coming, not just in all of us using generative AI to do things like write emails, read emails. This conversation, if it's being recorded, generative AI could take it, transcribe it, take actions out of it. If you or I gave one another an action like this book recommendation, it would send emails saying buy these books to these people, or it would tell you and I in our accounts to order them. All of that is available today, but we're getting to the point where we can put that capability on the client, and we really want people to be able to benefit from that power over these next years. So it's an exciting time. We're going to get a lot of capability people can't even imagine. I get emotional about it too.
I had never even, obviously this is why I'm not in tech. This is a fascinating idea. So instead of it going literally, like you said, to the cloud, it's local. And I guess the best example I can give people is doing Zoom for this recording versus what we're doing with Riverside. So the quality that comes out, because it's all recorded locally, both audio and visually, I want to simplify it for people so they understand, like, it's remarkably better than what, and this is not a thing on Zoom. I'm not bashing them, but when you can do it locally, it's like we're almost doing it live. Is that going to kind of be the feel when this computer comes out? I mean, that sounds amazing.
There's going to be improvements in the offerings like this, the ways that we talk. Just taking this way that we're talking, right? Two cameras staring at us and us looking at them. These capabilities I'm describing will allow a lot more work to be done on the device right now. So at the moment, and for the devices you and I are using, probably desktops, Power management's not the biggest issue, but if you're using a notebook somewhere because you're on the move, having the device really able to make you appear your best, to blur out the background, to make sure that your eye tracking, right, if you're looking at the screen rather than looking at the camera, all of these things can be done on the device in a way that makes that experience better. So, yeah, it's a bright future for the next few years in this space of user at the edge capabilities, making our lives easier and better, yeah.
Man, and you get to do this on a daily basis. You're at the cutting edge. That's really cool. Dave, I have so many questions. Like, you have led a fascinating life. You're helping people around the world. I don't know what I don't know, so I'm going to give you an open forum here and just say, what didn't I know enough to ask Dave that you're like, dude, we have to share this before we wrap this interview up?
That I'm passionate about, which I talk about often in these sorts of conversations, is the philosophy of the Stoics or Stoicism. It's a, as you will have heard, I'm sure, a Greek philosophy. It had some pretty famous adherents to it. There are some modern day folks who talk about it. There were Roman emperors. Marcus Aurelius was a fan. Again, I recommend, I'll give another book recommendation. Marcus Aurelius wrote something not meant actually as a publication. He wrote it for himself called Meditations. I encourage people to read it. Don't tell me you've got it there.
Oh, brother, it's with me at all times. Like, it's fantastic. I didn't mean to derail, but 1,000%.
Glad to meet a fellow traveler. I think there's a lot in the philosophy. And I think people, and I don't have to explain to you, but maybe to your listeners, people sometimes misunderstand it. They think it's about being stone-faced or being unemotional. And I find the opposite. I find that it encourages us to take joy from what we have rather than to constantly be waiting for or looking for that next thing. And in that way, it's one of the most joyous ways you can approach life. It also encourages discipline, which we have talked about. It also encourages focus on what you can control. In the workplace, there are always things you can't control. You can be out of control of the strategy of the company if you're, in middle management, or you can be unable to control the marketplace if you're in senior management. And so there will always be something that is out of your control. And among other things, the Stoics encourage us to focus on that which we can control, and that allows us to have an impact that doesn't frustrate us and doesn't distract us. And so I encourage people to read that. There's another, we started this conversation around my work with our Disability Impact Network. There's another publication by Seneca, you've probably got it, On the Shortness of Life, I think is a wonderful publication. And there's just all the material that the Stoics wrote, and Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius, among others, I encourage people to read, because a lot of that work is good. On the Shortness of Life, very brief book, and it encourages us to remember why and what we're here for, and not to lose time or waste time in the pursuit of what's important to us. So that I always encourage people to think about when we get into this sort of a subject.
Yeah, I cannot second this more. It's one of those things where, we think we're so unique and we think that our world is so ahead of, whatever in the past. Look, history repeats itself. And here's what I would offer to people. The book he's talking about is incredible, both of them. But Meditations, for me, is something that I read on a daily. And if you don't fall in love with Stoicism, I'll offer one other, which is Taoism. Tao Te Ching is one of those books that I read on a daily basis. And I think it's that perspective piece, Dave, and that's come up so many times, to say, look, people have experienced whatever you're going through, no matter the hardship or the accolade, somebody has gone through it. So you're not alone. And you're not that unique and special. And that doesn't mean in a bad way. It just means, look, there's things that you could learn about this. You can have this perspective. You don't have to get your ass kicked so bad, I guess, is the long and the short.
Most people are kicking their own ass. That's the problem, right? It's mostly what's going on between the ears that makes people feel bad, rather than what's going on, outside of them. And so that, as you say, that practice of, or that reading of this content, just helped me and helps others, I'm sure, remember that we're in control of our thoughts. And if we find joy around us, if we find the positive, if we focus on what we can control, that life is better than if we don't do any of those things. So yeah, I agree.
So good. So good. Dave, you're an interesting guy, man. I appreciate you coming on. If people wanted to connect with you, I don't know if that's something you're looking for specifically for people to connect with you online. I mean, you have so much to offer. You've experienced so much. I just think you're one of those unique people that really bring so much to the table. So if people wanted to reach out and have more Dave in their life, where's the best place for them to do that?
LinkedIn is easy. My email address, I'll give it to them. It's very easy. dmq@hp.com. People can connect me to me with that or on any of the social platforms that they can find me on. But I'm open to it. I love talking about this stuff and connecting. I think, as I said it earlier, every successful person I know is where they are because others helped them. And if I can be of any help to anyone in advancing what they care about, I'd love to be a part of it.
So good, man. So good. I thank you for coming on, man. Truly, the conversation we span so much, but yet your humility and bringing that to the table, it's really remarkable to see that in a leader is at such a high level. So thank you, brother. I really appreciate you coming on.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Guys, he gave you his email address. Use it. He's literally saying, I would love to help you. If you're sitting there going, you know what? I want to get to the level Dave has reached. Reach out. This is somebody that's literally giving you an offer and you can take it, but you have to take action. So I would just say, look him up on LinkedIn. He gave the email address, man. That guy is, he must have AI reading it, but no, definitely reach out to him. And you guys remember, your mindset matters. I appreciate all of you so very much. We'll talk soon.